You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play the Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of The Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
No purchase necessary. VGW Group. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply.
From Shakespeare to Schwartz, from Fosse to Alvin Ailey, from Sondheim to Bareilles, from McNally to Faye. It happened to the greats, it still happens every day.
When lightning strikes,
it's the moment you know.
When lightning strikes,
where you're meant to go. You can stand and shout Eureka, do whatever you like. You'll never forget the moment when lightning strikes.
Hello, this is Gerald Brunner, and you are listening to When Lightning Strikes. This is a podcast where we talk about the moment when your proverbial light bulb goes off, the heavens open, the seas part. You have that wonderful, heart-thumping, tingly, glorious mic drop moment when you discovered you had to be an artist. And today, I'm so thrilled that we have Katie Braben, who won an Olivier Award playing Carol King in the West End premiere of Beautiful. And just, this is just a few of her theater credits, just a few. Girl from the North Country, Honor, A Walk on the Moon, The Spoils, My Mother Said I Never Should, King Charles III, American Psycho, and on television, she's been in Luther, The Alienist, Doctor Who, King Charles III, Vera, and you can now see her in the riveting film, A Serial Killer's Guide to Life. So welcome, Katie.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. This is lovely.
I'm so happy to have you. Where are you right now, and how are you staying fortified in this?
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's tough, isn't it? I'm actually currently in a cupboard, and I've got my soft sort of things around me because I sometimes do some recording in here. So I've put myself in the cupboard with the door open, so hopefully the sound's okay. And I'm in London. How am I sort of keeping it together? I'm very lucky. I have a lovely boyfriend who keeps me sane at the moment. And I'm currently doing a lot of running and, jogging really, and reading and, yeah, just, you know, speaking to people as much as possible because, it's tough right now, isn't it?
It's very tough. Not to sound so dramatic, but it's hour to hour, sometimes minute to minute. Some days I'm just feeling like I'm a font of creativity and possibilities. And then some days it's, oh boy, what's going on right now?
Yeah, it's so, having that sort of purpose taken away from you. So you sort of wake up in the morning and you're like, oh, I have to sort of create something in my own brain, you know, to keep myself going. So yeah, I have been feeling that. Yeah, for sure.
Because you were just in rehearsal for Jeremy O'Harris's play Daddy, right?
Yeah, I'm really sad that there's, you know, obviously a hope for the future that maybe, you know, that it will go on. But if it doesn't, I'll be really sad that people won't see these amazing performances that I got to witness in rehearsals from the cast. So we were just about to go into tech. So, yeah, I think there was even a swimming pool sort of being constructed in the Alameda Theatre, which is no small feat. So that's sort of sadly not to be at the moment. But great to be in the room with Jeremy O'Harris and Daniel Taymor, who was directing as well. I mean, they're extraordinary brains, you know, were amazing to sort of witness in the room. So I feel like I had some experience of working with them, which was with better than nothing, I suppose.
I want to get back to that because I saw the play with Alan Cumming at Signature Theater in New York, and it was, oh gosh, it was so powerful and heart thumping. And you're right, that set just took my breath away.
Yeah. Amazing set. And such an interesting sort of, Jeremy Harris is such an interesting voice, and I think he's so playful and so interesting. And to get the chance to kind of dig into that text a bit, even for, you know, 3 or 4 weeks was really wonderful.
It's so extraordinary just to have that experience with him. Let's go to your lightning strikes moment. When did you know, or were there several moments where you knew, you know, reaching back into your vault of when you knew, you know, oh gosh, I have to be an artist?
Well, you know, it's really interesting. Obviously, I know that this is what this podcast is about, and I have been thinking about it a lot. I have a terrible memory, so I don't have like a lightning strikes moment. And also, I feel like when I was younger, I mean, basically, I feel like I've always known that I wanted to be an actor. I couldn't tell you when the moment happened. But I feel like, in a way, everything in my life from that moment, whenever that was, is just like a test of that, if that makes sense. So I can tell you about moments where that has been tested, and I can also talk about moments where I felt like that calling has been compounded. But I couldn't give you an exact, you know, lightning strikes, that was it. I just knew. But I suppose going back through my brain, when I was about 10 years old, I got to sort of share the part of Annie in a very amateur production in Lewisham in the shopping centre. So it was sort of bizarre, actually. I don't know if it still exists, but it was a sort of theatre, but inside a shopping centre. And I'm sure it's still there, but I don't think it gets used at all, which is a shame. It was a sort of 3 nights, and I think I played Annie once maybe in those 3 nights. But I can remember my mum, because I cried when it was over, and I really mourned it. And I can remember being in the bath and my mum sort of soaping me down as I was crying. And she was like, and I remember her saying something like, well, if this is how you react when you do drama, then I don't think you should do it anymore. Which was kind of the opposite of how I was feeling, because obviously I was so in love with, but not just being on stage, but I think for me, and it's always been about this since that moment, it's about the coming together of people to create something, you know, like the camaraderie and, you know, the backstage stuff as well as the onstage stuff, the learning, the growing as a person. And all of that for me is sort of tied up in theatre specifically. So that was one of my sort of moments. Yeah.
What made you go to step two to follow the next theatrical experience?
Well, I had really great teachers in secondary school. I had a great singing teacher. I mean, I should say that my parents are musicians. So I grew up with listening to a lot of folk and blues music, They're specifically blues, amazing blues musicians. So I was already sort of singing at a very young age, I suppose. But I knew I wanted to be an actor. It was sort of more so than a singer. I can remember being at school, and I had this great singing teacher called Joanne Hansen. I had this great drama teacher called Margaret Wilman. And they were just amazing. They just were very supportive. And I didn't know there was such a thing as a drama college, really, until Margaret Wilman told me about it. And I applied for two, I think. And I remember getting the information through for RADA, and I just threw it straight in the bin because I was like, just the thought of that was too much for me. Like, I didn't have that entitlement at all. I didn't think from hearing about it that I could possibly have even dreamed of going somewhere like that. So I sort of put that straight in the bin. But I did apply for two, and I got into one, luckily. It's been a slow thing for me. Like, every place that I've turned up at, whether it's drama college or a job or, you know, whatever venue I've worked at, I've always felt this massive sense of, wow, like, this is amazing. Like, I got here, I got to the National Theatre, or, you know, I managed to get a job at the Alameda. I always feel huge sort of gratitude is the wrong word, but so sort of passionate about it that wherever I end up, I'm just really like thrilled, to be honest with you.
Was that the Rose Bruford?
Yeah, I went to Rose Bruford, and I remember when I applied, I did the acting musician course. So, because I play instruments and I am a songwriter as well, they're my two passions, you know. And I thought, oh, I get to put these two passions together. I didn't realize that it was actually a course for people who play instruments on stage. That was kind of a shock for me when I got there, and that's what it was about. I haven't actually done, as a professional actor, much acting musician work. Subsequently, but I did love that, you know, at the time, the course, you know, you just, on a Wednesday afternoon, you just all just played your instruments. It was great, you know, and I really enjoyed that. But it was the acting course with sort of a bit of music at the time, but I think it's different now. I wouldn't like to say what it's like now. I don't know.
Are there roles that really stand out for you that you did there in school?
Yeah, actually, there was it wasn't a whole play, but I remember we did, basically to push us, they gave us these roles that we would never sort of get given. And one of them I remember doing with my best friend, David, and it was a scene from Blood Wedding. And I was playing the mother and he was playing the bridegroom. And it was just a scene, but I remember... you know, because it's so far removed from, you know, these sort of very English people doing this Andalusian, you know, very passionate scene. I completely was so absorbed in the character that I don't really remember what happened when we performed it, which is, you know, something I'm always chasing, I have to say, as an actor, and very rarely get to experience. But that feeling of that it's outside of yourself, like it takes you away, and you're so sort of involved in the character that you kind of, you know, you give yourself up to it, really. And that's why I guess I love sort of transformative actors and like to be able to try and do that as an actor myself.
Yeah, because it's so fascinating to me when I think about the breadth of the roles you've played, the characters, you know, and you think about Carole King and then Lou, you know, and then everyone in between that you really dive in, you know, to whomever you're playing.
Yeah, I think, I hope, yeah, I really enjoy how imaginative the work is, I think. It's very hard to analyze it, isn't it? I suppose. But I love how imaginative it is. And actually, the furthest away from yourself, I feel, in a way, the more playful you can be. And that doesn't mean that it doesn't, that the character doesn't have shades of you in it. But for me to be able to be playful and, you know, to fully delve in, sometimes it's fun to play people who are very different from you, actually.
Can you talk about your one of your first professional gigs out of school, how that happened, how you went from being a student to a professional?
Well, I feel like I'm still a student. And I don't mean that, like, I know that sounds silly, but I mean, I just love, and this is what I'm missing at the moment. I love the fact that when you walk into a rehearsal room, you are just like at square one, and you just, you get to like learn. You get to learn about the time in which the play is set. You get to learn about the people. You get to learn about the history. And if it's something that's modern, you get to sort of delve into some extraordinary like personalities. And I always feel like I'm learning. But in terms of becoming a professional,
I didn't mean to incite.
No, it's just like some of the first jobs I did were like pretty terrible. I'm trying to remember some of them now. Some of them were really good fun though. Like I had really good fun on some jobs that I did when I left college. I suppose the job that really sort of pushed me was, funny enough, it was Mamma Mia, playing Sophie in Mamma Mia, which was probably my biggest thing after college. And I found that incredibly challenging, actually. And I think it should have been more fun than I made it, because it's a really fun musical. But I think because I was very serious about acting, I was very serious about, telling this young woman's story. And it taught me a lot, actually. It taught me a lot doing Mamma Mia, even though I think maybe I was a kind of square peg in a round hole. In that show, I definitely learned my limitations and my strengths, and I'm very grateful for that experience.
And that was the 10th anniversary production, right?
Yeah,
How long was it roughly after you graduated that you landed that role? Was it pretty?
I mean, a while. Yes. I mean, it wasn't a quick thing, and also, you know, after that, I didn't work for ages. You know, it's like, I always find it interesting, you know, you think that there's going to be this trajectory where you, I don't know, play a certain role or do a certain thing and then you're done. It's fine. Everyone knows who you are. You don't have to audition anymore. You could just, you know, enjoy yeah. sort of the work. But that's never happened for me, you know, in my whole career. I've always sort of, you know, been incredibly lucky and done great things, but then, you know, been working at the pub again or waitressing or doing something else. The funny thing was that role came out of, I had done some workshops in Poland with this great, amazing theatre company called Theatre Piss in Kozła, and I'd worked with a woman there, and she knew this director and said, oh, you should get this girl into audition for the show he was doing. And that was, the Smiths, the band, the Smiths, they were doing a musical it was an opera. There was no text involved in it, but, they were doing that show and I auditioned for that and got a role in that. And then after that, the director, was also directing the tour of Mamma Mia. So he got me in for that. So it, the kind of bizarre sort of way that things work out, you know, like you wouldn't have thought doing a sort of very physical theater, experience in Poland would lead me to like a huge commercial, West End musical. So I'm always interested in those connections. I think they're kind of amazing when you look at life in that way.
You were recently in one of my favorite pieces, girl from the North Country play Elizabeth Lane, right? And can you talk about that experience working with Connor McPherson, doing this gorgeous Bob Dylan musical? I feel like I heard those songs for the first time, especially hearing you sing Like a Rolling Stone. I just love that rendition so much. But when you heard about Girl from the North Country, what went through your mind? What was that experience like?
Because it's so interesting. I mean, I watched the show when it was on at the Old Vic, and then in the West End. And when I got a call from my agent saying, you know, they'd like to see you. And I was thinking, for who? I mean, I didn't think there was a role in it for me. They said, for Elizabeth, I was thinking, that's unusual. But my God, yes, I'd love to give that a try. You know, what a brilliant, you know, opportunity to, you know, sit down in front of Connor and to audition for him with that role. He's amazing. You know, he really is amazing. He gives you an extraordinary amount of freedom. And his direction is so spot on, but also so sleight of hand that he makes you feel like, you know, you're coming up with things yourself. But actually, I'm sure that it's, you know, it's all part of his sort of plan. But he does. He gives you a lot of freedom as an actor. And I felt that immediately in the audition, in the room. I felt very at ease, you know, and felt like, okay, I'm going to do, you know, what comes to me in this moment. I've always loved Dylan. I've always been a massive fan of Dylan. And his versions of the songs were in my heart whilst doing that show, definitely. And Simon Hale, who did the arrangements, is just an utter genius. And he, you know, in London, you know, in our version of it, you know, being in the room and being able to like experience like, I don't know, all these incredible voices just sort of singing at you. It's an intense experience. I'm glad that you love the piece so much. I mean, it was a joy to do. And actually, even more so at the moment, I feel like just having had the experience of that, I feel very lucky. To have had that experience.
He really is a poet, and his words, and then mixed with the musical arrangements, it's a visceral experience. And I was able to see it at both the Public and on Broadway, and also the ensemble work is magnificent. I remember hearing from my friends who saw it in the UK how special it was. What do you love about Elizabeth? God, she's so complex.
She's so complex, and I love her honesty. I love the fact that she can sniff out a good'un and a bad'un. You know, she's like she just knows. She just knows, and it's so sort of deep within her that she can suss that out in people. I love her freedom, and I think I remember saying at the time, like, I've never felt so free and so afraid in the same breath being on stage. Like it was really challenging, but in that way as well, really, I learned a lot. You know, I learned an awful lot doing that. Yeah.
Not to sound too hippy dippy, but she's almost like the seer, you know, like she's like this moral center of it, of all this chaos that's going on in this boarding house, a very complicated time, you know, during the Great Depression.
And that last speech, you know, like, and I remember when I watched it, just being so utterly moved by that speech. To be able to, you know, express that sort of almost bizarre third person, in fact, they talked about it in rehearsals as it's sort of like Nick's song, because Nick doesn't get to sing, he doesn't get a song. But yeah, through her, through this speech, he has some kind of release, you know, he has all that pent up energy that he carries throughout those experiences that he's not able to express through song like everybody else is in the play, is sort of done through that speech, which I really love.
It's beautiful. And what about, because your parents, you just said, are musicians and are artists, did that inform the piece for you or help you kind of navigate your way through or give you even more of a special connection to the music of Bob Dylan?
I suppose yes. The answer is yes to that. I mean, I think it's really hard to put into words what having that upbringing, you know, has done for me in terms of my connection to a lot of the pieces that I've done. With Beautiful, the Carole King musical as well, you know, being, yeah, you know, having been absorbed, you know, having that sort of musical education as a kid, I think has been invaluable. Yeah.
Did you grow up going on tour and what was that like?
Interestingly, that wasn't, there was like buggies in the wings at concerts and things. Yeah. But, there wasn't a lot, and I'm kind of, you know, there wasn't a lot of moving around for my parents, because when they decided to have kids, they kind of like, they became teachers as well. So it's like, they do more music now. When we got older, they kind of locked back into doing their music, but they sort of became teachers whilst me and my sister were growing up. So there wasn't like much moving around. But I do remember when we were kids, the thing that I was sort of like another lightning bolt moment, I suppose. But when we were kids, we used to camp in France, and we used to take like guitars and things and, you know, sit out and sing together and make this lovely sort of family harmonizing sound. And that was something very special growing up. But also, like, the songs we used to listen to in the car have a very deep sort of, they resonate very deep with me. And I used to have these sort of these fantasies as that, like, I was singing the songs that were being played and that you know, interestingly, because I mean, it's a long way of saying, people have said to me, like, why, you know, how did you, why musical theatre? You must be very passionate about musical theatre and, you know, you've done a lot of it. And I never thought that I was really interested in musical theatre necessarily. But when I think back to those times, like, I was creating this sort of imaginative world where I was singing to like the boy I liked, or, you know, I was like being heroic in a moment. And that feels to me very musical theater, bizarrely. Like,
praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com.
Great expectations.
The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at OutsidersMusical.com.
Your storytelling. Do you remember, if you don't worry, but do you remember some of the things you sang in the car or around the campfire?
Well,
or was it their material?
So we used to sing around the campfire. We used to sing things like Buddy Holly songs and stuff. Oh. But in the car, they used to play like the Judds and and Hall & Oates and things like that. So like really, and Whitney Houston and Aretha Franklin, but not necessarily the kind of Bob Dylan, Carole King stuff. It was like quite different vibe in the car. So yeah, it would be like the Judds and like whatever you think of the Judds, like they're like mini stories, those songs, yeah. And you know, those country songs.
Great.
So yeah. I suppose I had that kind of those little stories running through my head as a kid in the back of the car there in France. So I think that as a little explanation, even to myself, of why musical theater has been in my life.
And I love that you played Carole King. Is there something you remember about your dealings with Carole King?
Oh, well, I mean, so I said very, very early on to the cast and crew and everyone, I was like, if Carole King ever comes to see the show, I don't want to know. Like, because you cannot be on stage and play someone who's sitting in the audience. That to me is just, my brain would be, ticking over with anxiety. So I said, I never want to know when she's in. And, kudos to everyone, because opening night comes around and I didn't know, but she was in the audience. And bear in mind, this is press night, which is in the UK is like everyone comes at once. It's, it's the most horrible night ever. And my friend Lorna, who played, brilliantly played Cynthia Weil, who won an Olivier for her performance. She said to me in the dressing room just before, she said, have you looked on Twitter at all? And I was like, no, it's 5 minutes to the show. Why would I go on Twitter? And she was like, oh, good, 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 good. Unbeknownst to me, obviously, she didn't want me to see that Twitter had blown up because Carole King was in the building. So, so yeah, my overriding memory anyway of meeting Carole King was after the bows of our opening night. She comes up on stage and sings a bit of You Got a Friend, which was, mind-blowing experience. Yeah, totally, totally brilliant. So glad I didn't know she was in. It's too much pressure, a press night anyway. So, don't need that added pressure.
Yeah, that sounds like a lot of pressure. Is there something, if it's too personal, I understand. Is there something she told you that really resonates with you or sticks out? Or I can't even imagine being Carole King and seeing that in the pit. Because I've heard, I heard that when it opened on Broadway, that it was just too painful, and it took her a while to finally see the whole thing through. That she saw a rehearsal, the first act, and then had to leave because I can't imagine.
That's totally understandable. Yeah. I mean, I couldn't imagine. I mean, nobody would want to do a play in my life, but I mean, I couldn't imagine sitting through something, that is essentially you, your life when you were 16 to 28. That's a bizarre experience, I imagine. She said some really cool stuff, and we had a chat. I mean, we didn't have like a long chat or anything, but I do remember her saying, you know how I love my cats. And I was like, oh, cats. I was thinking, she has a cat. Does she mean she mean her cat that she has? And actually she meant obviously her musicians. And what she was saying to me was a bit of advice for on stage, where she was like, just show them a little bit more love in the scenes, which I kind of thought was brilliant, because it's such a subtle thing for her to pick up on, that kind of small, like on stage, like nods to the bass player and nods to the band and really feeling it. And I just thought that was such a great thing to say.
It's funny, because when you first said cat, I was thinking, or cats, I was thinking of Tapestry. And that,
yeah, that's what I thought as well.
They're in the windowsill.
Yeah. It's sort of another word for musicians, I think.
Yeah.
In the
60s. I love that.
Yeah. So lovely. But yeah, she was great.
Now for something really different. The movie, so A Serial Killer's Guide to Life, it's available to be streamed. It's on Amazon Prime here in the States. Can you talk about that experience? Oh boy. Talk about
it's hard to like sort of truncate like how that came about. But basically, I'm friends with a couple of geniuses, Poppy Rowe and Stanton's cousin Rowe, and they are a married couple, and we've been friends for a long time, and we made a short film together that Stanton wrote, and we filmed the whole thing in their little flat at the time they were living in Charlton. They had this little flat, we filmed the whole thing in there, and that was called This Way Out, which is actually like totally free now online if you can find it. It's a great little film. And I wrote the credits music and the music at the end as well, just as a little thing there. But so that happened. And then Stanton always wanted to write like a feature, and he's a brilliant, brilliant filmmaker. But there's something about the amazing sort of ingenuity and tenacity of the two of them together. They're quite a team. And so they came up with the Serial Killer's Guide to Life, which is basically about a woman called Lou, who I play, who is sort of downtrodden. I think she has like arrested development, and she's obsessed with self-help, and she lives in this sort of little seaside town, and she's really squashed by her mother, and she still lives with her mom and stuff. And she meets this life coach called Val. But unbeknownst to her, Val is a murderer. So, I mean, you've seen the film.
Yes.
So, so yeah, I mean, it's good. We filmed it in 2 weeks. 2 weeks.
2 weeks?
Yeah.
Wow.
And we kickstarted the money, and it was an amazing success, the Kickstarter campaign. And I have so many people to thank for that, for putting their money in and for believing in the project. It was really amazing.
You're really on the edge of your seat throughout, because you don't know what's going to happen next. It's so... It's terrifying, but also there's this element, you're very invested in these characters, and I was just rooting for Lou, and I don't want to give it away, but it's really fascinating to see her transformation and this sort of epic buddy picture-esque-ness.
There's nothing better than working with your friends on something like that. I mean, it tests your friendships, but it's like amazing. It's and to have something written with you in mind, or with you playing the character in mind, is like amazing. I've never had that experience before.
Are you a fan of the genre? I mean, it's even hard to put it into a genre. I know I've seen it described as a thriller or horror, but it's not your sort of run-of-the-mill horror picture. It's really in a class by itself, I would say.
Yeah, well, that's nice of you to say. I mean, I think so too. I think it defies genre, and actually think like Girl from the North Country defies genre as well. But I happen to think that art that defies genre is it's hard to get made. but when it does, it's like so refreshing. And I know that Staton certainly wanted to keep his vision with it, which is why it was kind of mostly funded by, no one had a big producer hold over it. It was very much, like I say, funded by Kickstarter and self-funded. And I think that's really important if you've got a strong vision that doesn't fit a specific genre, because people are so interested in putting stuff in boxes to be able to sort of sell it, I suppose, that sometimes it's difficult to get that stuff made.
You know, another genre-defying piece, Daddy. Look at that piece and how completely original that is. What do you remember about, or what stands out about working with Jeremy O'Harris?
Oh my gosh. I mean, he's just extraordinary. I could listen to him talk for hours. I just love the way he speaks. And he's just got an extraordinary brain, really. And he's very kind and very supportive. Well, wonderful to be in the room with him. I'm gutted that so far, you know, we've not been able to do it. I know there's hope that we will be able to. I'm just so interested in working with interesting people with visions, you know, and I'm just like, yeah, I'll jump on board. I just jump on board other people's brilliant ideas, basically, if I can.
I love that. And what about working in the U.S.? Because you've worked in the U.S. as well. What do you like about coming here and working in the United States?
I really love just meeting people from different places. I love it. Just different ways of life, different ways of being. In a way, I don't think the artistic industries are that different in America to here. I think the people that I've met are challenging and pushing boundaries, and I see that wherever I work, really.
Did you grow up going to the States, or do you remember one of the first trips you took here?
No, I'd never been to the States. I went for a holiday with some friends years ago, and I remember one of the biggest cultural differences was because I was working at a bar at the time in London, and I remember we went for New Year's Eve. And I remember going to a bar, like the Cellar Bar or something like that, I think it was called in downtown. I think it was downtown New York. But anyway, I remember looking around like halfway through the night, and there were just dollar bills on the counter, you know, on the bar. Mm-hmm. And I was like, wow, that's amazing, because obviously working as a bar person in London, you get like maybe a pound tip if you're lucky, you know, every shift. So there was this bar full of like notes. I couldn't quite get my head around it. So that was like the biggest cultural difference for me when I first went to New York. But no, I love New York. I love the vibe of New York, and obviously, it's just really sad at the moment that we're all going through this. But I hope one day to go back, you know?
Yeah. We'll travel again. I know we will.
Yeah.
And what about, you said you were writing music during this time. I know you're a musician and a songwriter. And what does that give you?
Oh, I mean, I, you know, speaking to my boyfriend the other day, and he said that when we met, I said my two passions are writing music and acting. And apparently I said at the time I couldn't be without either. But I realized I haven't really written music in a while. And it's a great passion of mine. And it's kind of amazing to be afforded the time to just sit, you know, just sit with an instrument and see what happens. So I've been doing that, but it's mostly sort of for my own sanity. It's not really, you know, I don't want to say it's a hobby, but it's sort of keeping me sane. And I put something out there on Instagram the other day, and I'm not used to doing that. So maybe this is me getting, you know, better at that. And maybe I'll put more of my music out there. We'll see.
Dippy, how would you describe your music? Or is it, again, hard to, genre define?
Genre defying. I mean, I don't know if it's that, but I guess I'm so influenced by so many different styles of music that it would be hard for me to say exactly what it was. The song that I put out there feels really folky, but equally I've written things that aren't, so I don't know. I mean, I think it just is what it wants to be in the moment.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask you about The Spoils, Jesse Eisenberg's play. What was the joy of working on The Spoils with Jesse?
I'd say that's one of my favorite experiences actually as an actor, because, Jesse Eisenberg is amazing. He's an amazing actor, writer, again, very generous, and kind and very open to, like, you know, I kind of thought, oh no, you know, what happens when you're on stage with the writer? Does that mean you have to like actually do the words and get it right? And, but actually it made for such a playful, experience, him, you know, being the writer and on stage, gave us a lot of freedom. You know, he's so, so playful and, so, you know, so enjoys, you know, for want of a better word, just enjoys acting, enjoys, you know, working with people. And it really was a joy to do that show every night. And it felt so real and sort of so fly on the wall. And especially in the small, lovely venue of the Trafalgar Studios, which is so intimate. Yeah, it was just great to do that show.
And one thing you said was that you thought, that maybe working with a playwright, you say their words and then acting with them might be challenging, but it wasn't the case in terms of having their words be precious, right?
Yeah, exactly. He never felt like he was precious about anything, but obviously you wanted to get it right because it's so brilliantly written. But the sort of like naturalization of the text, I suppose, if that's a word, you know, the ums and the ahs and the kind of like just what I did then. He was very open to that sort of thing. And I love that. Like I love really sort of very real naturalistic, plays when I, as an audience member, I love things like, I don't know if you saw Downstate, for example, but, like a play like that, that's set in one room, sort of almost real time. I find that thrilling as an audience member.
Well, Katie, you've just been so wonderful. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Oh, it's been lovely. Thank you for having me on.
Thank you so much and have a lovely day.
You too. Every day when lightning strikes,
it's the moment you know. The theme song was written by Tom McGovern. This episode was edited by Kyle Moore, and the talent was booked by Anna Strauss.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical. Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Supps has arrived on Broadway and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suppsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.